We're getting on into the book of Isaiah this evening. We had the overview of the minor prophets last time, introduction to the minor or the major prophets rather, and tonight we're getting into the opening chapters of the book of Isaiah, going to cover the first 14 chapters. Now, as we mentioned last time, Isaiah's name means the eternal is salvation, and that name fits very closely with the subject matter of Isaiah's writing. There are a number of things that are brought out here. Isaiah was writing historically at the time when the Assyrian Empire was in ascendancy. He began writing prior to the Assyrian invasion of northern Israel and continued his ministry on down through the captivity of northern Israel and through the time when Assyria invaded Judah. And that story is told in the book of Isaiah, that of God's deliverance of Jerusalem. Isaiah was a prophet for the southern kingdom, and his focus was to a great extent on that southern kingdom. Most of his ministry took place during the days of the he began in the very final period of King Uzziah's life, probably the final year. That's the dating of Isaiah 6. And then Uzziah's son Jotham, Ahaz, who was Uzziah's grandson, and then Hezekiah, who was the son of Ahaz. And those were the primarily, Ahaz and Hezekiah seem to have been the primary time of Isaiah's ministry. One of the things that comes in here, though northern Israel was the one that went into captivity during that time period, it's very clear as you look at the opening introductory chapters of Isaiah that Judah was guilty of many of the very same things. And the question, of course, was Judah going to learn from what happened to Israel? Sadly, it seems so many refuse to learn from the experience of others and wind up having to learn it the hard way themselves. And the point is made in terms of what happened with northern Israel and the fact that Judah could face the same thing. Isaiah goes on while showing what the Assyrians were going to do and the fact that God was going to punish the Assyrians. He went on to show that Babylon would ultimately arise. And realize that the time Isaiah wrote those prophecies, the rise of Babylon was almost 100 years in the future. From the time the end of Isaiah's ministry, the rise of Babylon was still almost 75 years away. So Isaiah was able to look down through time under God's inspiration and to show, in fact, he told King Hezekiah Babylon was ultimately going to come back. If you remember the story, after Hezekiah was delivered from the Assyrians and was healed, the Babylonians had sent an ambassador to come and visit him, and Hezekiah was feeling pretty expansive, and he showed the ambassador around and gave him a tour of his treasure house and all the things that he had, really wanted to impress the Babylonians. And Isaiah told him, you know, that really wasn't very smart. They're going to remember that. The time's going to come. They're going to come back and they're going to take it all. Well, Isaiah looked on down to see the rise of Babylon and then the fact that Babylon would also be punished. You know, that's one of the things that comes through when you read the prophets, is the realization that God rules in history. It's not just a matter of accident or happenstance. God is powerful enough that he has a plan that overreaches the other things, and is God rules in terms of history, declares the end from the beginning, as Isaiah brings out. Now, one of the things that is made clear in the book of Isaiah, one emphasis, is the fact that God does not permit uncleanness in his covenant people. He will punish their iniquity. Being part of the covenant people did not mean that you had a license to sort of get by with anything. It's not a matter that God just plays favorites, and if he likes certain people, well, they get by with it. The book of Isaiah opens with an indictment because of Judah's covenant breaking. However, he looks past those things and that punishment and the fact that God will restore and bless Israel following their national repentance. Now, Isaiah is also one of the most strongly messianic books in the Old Testament. There are many prophecies of the Messiah. The book of Isaiah, along with the book of Psalms, represents two of the most heavily quoted books in the New Testament. They were very commonly quoted, and part of that is because of so many of the prophecies of the Messiah. And, of course, many of them reference Christ's first coming, but many more reference the second coming. The ultimately, you see Isaiah look down to God's punishment for various evils and then the ultimate restoration and glory when the Messiah appears. And again, this theme of the eternal is salvation, you know, is they were confronted with the specific problems the nation was encountering at the time. Isaiah's message to King Hezekiah, or to King Ahab, later to King Hezekiah, his son, was look to God. Trust God for your deliverance. Trust God. Now, Ahaz was unwilling to do that, and Hezekiah was. But Isaiah focused on that, and even in the context of showing that there would be punishment for covenant breaking, the fact that, again, the eternal is salvation. The Messiah would come, things would be resolved. One thing the crisis in his own time that Isaiah commented upon really served to set the stage for prophecies that relate to our day. And that, what you find as you go through is that many of the very same sins, the same attitudes are extant. And when you put the book of Isaiah together with the other prophecies, it's very clear that much of what it contains looks on beyond his day. It is and there are prophecies, there are statements in the book of Isaiah that certainly refer clearly to the end times. Now, while Isaiah wrote primarily concerning Judah and Jerusalem, as he makes plain in chapter 1, verse 1, the events that happened to Judah and Jerusalem were signs for the house of Israel. Ezekiel makes that plain in Ezekiel 4, that there were parallels between what happened to Judah and what happened to Jerusalem and what would ultimately happen to the house of Israel in the end time. Beyond this, the destruction that people could see lay the salvation of God, which was the only hope of Israel. And Isaiah kept trying to sort of lift their eyes to look beyond the problems of their time and their day to see the fact that God is delivered. Now, we're going to go through the first 14 chapters. Chapter 1 is basically an indictment. It's almost like you're having your day in court, and here's an indictment. Israel is indicted as a sinful nation. They have transgressed the covenant, and they're going to receive God's wrath. Now, the next several chapters, chapters 2, 3, 4, and 5, we open with a picture of Christ's millennial reign, and then a detailed indictment of Israel's sins as a society and the prophecies of captivity and destruction. In chapter 6, all of this sort of sets the stage. Chapter 6 begins what was probably the very first chronologically. It is the story of Isaiah's call. So the focus of the book of Isaiah is not on Isaiah personally. It's only after the introduction of the first five chapters that he gives the story of God's calling of him. Now, chapters 7 and 8, we look at a prophecy of Judah was at that point facing a crisis with an alliance between Ephraim and Syria, Ephraim being the leading tribe of the northern 10 tribes. And Judah was facing a problem of this alliance from the north that was threatening them. This was during King Ahaz's reign. And Isaiah laid out the source of hope. Ahaz would not put his trust and confidence in God, and so there were going to be some hard lessons to learn. Chapters 9, 10, 11, and 12 again focus on the coming of the Messiah. They focus on God's use of Assyria to punish Israel, and then his redemption for Israel and his punishment of Assyria. The establishment of God's government is something that is detailed here in this section. Chapter 13 deals with the destruction of Babylon, and chapter 14 begins with restoring Israel to prosperity during the millennium, and then shows what is ultimately going to happen to the one who is in truth the king of Babylon, Satan himself, the one who is the real power behind the throne. Now, Isaiah opens here with this indictment, and in verse 2 he addresses, he says, "Hear, O heavens, give ear, O earth, the Lord has spoken. I've nourished and brought up my children, and they have rebelled against me." So God, in effect, issues an indictment. He says, "The ox knows his owner and the ass his master's crib, but Israel does not know, my people does not consider." So you may not think of a cow as being a particularly smart animal, but he's about one step up, God says, on the way a lot of people are. At least he knows his owner. A donkey, knows if you've ever ridden an animal, ridden a horse or for that matter a donkey, do the same thing. They know when they're headed home. They know when they're headed back to the barn. Boy, they begin to pick up speed. And the closer they get, it becomes almost impossible to turn them and get them to go in another direction. They know where they're headed. They're going to get some relief. You're going to get off their back. They're going to get something to eat. They got it all figured out. Now, if a dumb animal can figure out the source of his help and his sustenance, you would think people ought to be able to do the equivalent. And God says, "My people does not know. They don't consider it. Sinful nation, a people laden with iniquity, a seed of evildoers, children that are corruptors, they've forsaken the eternal. They have provoked the Holy One of Israel unto anger." He talks about the unsoundness, compares it to here in verse 6, to all sorts of bruises and putrefying sores. He describes a land that is desolate and cities burned with fire, strangers devouring the land in their presence. And he said in verse 9, "Except the Lord of hosts had left us as a small remnant, we would have been as Sodom and as Gomorrah." Then he said, verse 10, "Hear the word of the Lord, you rulers of Sodom. Give ear unto the law of our God, you people of Gomorrah." Now, that's a pretty strong indictment. Sodom and Gomorrah was, of course, used in Genesis, describing the sort of the epitome of an evil society that God destroyed. God labels our nation, he labels the leaders, the rulers of Sodom and the people of Gomorrah. Well, as you come on over a little bit further, it talks about the fact that God says that the nation declares its sin as Sodom. Now, there was a time years ago when we would read these verses and we would make these statements, but frankly, we couldn't comprehend how much like Sodom and Gomorrah our country would become. You could not have imagined years ago about being Gay Pride Weeks. Mayor proclaiming Gay Pride Week, and people marching, celebrating. Could you have imagined such a thing when you were growing up, or as our Boy Scouts? The issue has not died. Newsweek had a big cover article on it, and it just, it's sort of like the, when are the Boy Scouts going to get with the program and learn a little bit of tolerance? They're just being so unreasonable. They don't want homosexual men to take a bunch of little boys out in the woods on a camping trip. That, evidently strikes somebody as sort of being intolerant. It strikes me that anybody who can't see the problem with that is dumber than dumb. You don't have to be real smart to see why that wouldn't be a good idea. But you see, it is so characteristic that things have been turned upside down. That normal is considered abnormal. Oh, you got a hang up with that, huh? You got a problem. You're not tolerant. Well, God knew what he was saying, and when he indicted the nation as being like unto Sodom and Gomorrah, he said, "To what purpose is the multitude of your sacrifices unto me?" Verse 11. "I'm full of burnt offerings and rams, and the fat of fed beasts. I delight not in the blood of bullocks and lambs. When you come to appear before me, who's required this at your hand to tread my courts? Bring no more vain oblations. Incense is an abomination unto me. The new moons and Sabbaths, the calling of assemblies, I cannot away with. It is iniquity, even the solemn meeting. Your new moons and your appointed feast days my soul hates. They're a trouble to me. I'm weary to bear them. When you spread forth your hands, I'll hide my eyes. When you make many prayers, I won't hear. Your hands are full of blood. Wash you, make you clean. Put away your evil doings from before my eyes. Cease to do evil. Learn to do well. Seek judgment." Now, I read this because I want to make a point here on this. It's important to get something in the context. You know, it's amazing what a person can do with Scripture if you just pull a verse or half a verse out of context. There were those, as I think you realize, that got all bent out of shape about the issue of the calendar a while back. And one of the verses that they quoted, say, said, well, Isaiah 1:14 says, "Your new moons and your appointed feasts my soul hates." You see, you're keeping the wrong days. That has nothing to do with the context. The context, God talks about sacrifices. He talks about coming before him on these occasions. He talks about making prayers. God is fed up with people going through the outward manifestation of religion, the outward show of religion, when in reality they're not doing well, they're not seeking judgment, they're not relieving the oppressed, they're not being careful of the fatherless and the widows. Their hands are full of blood. The context goes on and talks about repentance. There was not a problem. I don't think there's any indication whatever that as you go on through the story here that the problem was that the Jews were having temple services on the wrong day. That they hadn't checked the NASA website and they were using something else to determine the new moon. That's what some of this bunch is doing. So that's not even under discussion. The problem that God is indicting is not the fact that people are coming before him or praying to him. The problem is that they are going through the outward show of religion. To so many, religion becomes something that as long as you go through the outward trappings, it's reduced down to coming to church. It's reduced to certain outward things. Is it wrong to come to church? No. Christ indicted the Pharisees. Was it because the Pharisees weren't keeping the Sabbath or they were observing the holy days incorrectly? That's not... The Pharisees were very meticulous on a lot of things, but they missed the whole point. They didn't have a relationship with God, and they weren't living it in their daily lives. It didn't impact the way they dealt with other people. It's an abomination in God's sight to go through the outward trappings, show up, try to impress everybody, and boy, I'm here for church, and I'm really this way, and I'm that way. And the way you deal with your family, the way you deal with your neighbor, the way you deal with people at work, the way you interact with others, ethics, morality, all of these things go by the board. That just the fact of sort of showing up at church is not going to make everything okay. That's sort of the world's idea of religion. And in the context here, who is Isaiah talking to? He's talking to the nation. He's indicting the nation that is going to receive God's punishment. And the problem... You see, and you can look around at our nation today, we're a religious people. All you got to do is look at a Gallup poll. Well, over 90% of the population of this country will tell you, oh yeah, we believe in God. You know, the overwhelming, over 90% of the homes have a Bible. So, we, in fact, it's sort of interesting if you look at criteria about believing in God or believing in certain things connected with God. The United States ranks right up there with India as one of the most religious nations on the face of the earth. And I think that's interesting because they're religious folks too. But, you know, there's a difference between being, quote, religious and really serving and obeying God. So we are a religious people, but is the issue that Isaiah is making here is of people going through the outward show of religion without it impacting their life. And it's important, I think, when we read something to get it in the context. One of the most important rules of Bible study. You read a verse, go back, get it in context. Who is it talking to? What is it talking about? Get it in context. So Isaiah told them in verse 18, come now, let us reason together, says the Lord. Though your sins be as scarlet, they will be white as snow. Though they be red like crimson, they will be as wool. If you be willing and obedient, you'll eat the good of the land. If you refuse and rebel, you'll be devoured with a sword. The mouth of the Lord has spoken it. That's the issue. They've gone through the trappings of religion, but they haven't been obeying. And God says, if you want to truly repent, then you can be forgiven. But he talks about, continues the indictment in verse 21, how's the faithful city become a harlot? That's the way God views it. Your princes are rebellious and the companions of thieves. Everyone loves gifts, follows after rewards. In a society where things are for sale, as far as justice is concerned. We have scandals on a regular basis of officials who are either in trouble for what they've done or, as it says, your princes are companions of thieves. You know, if the one who's in charge doesn't get in trouble, then his buddies do, and they go off to jail. And things are being stolen and sold. And you remember, of course, the scandals, they've sort of died down at this point, but right at the close of the Clinton administration, all the pardons and everything. Well, that's not the first time there's been a serious scandal, and it certainly won't be the last time, but it is anytime that sort of thing is commonplace, then it bodes ill for the nation. God talks about what that ultimately he will avenge his enemies, avenge himself of his enemies, verse 24. He'll purge away the dross, verse 25. Restore your judges as at the first and your counselors as at the beginning. Now, what were their judges and counselors like at the beginning? Well, if you go back to the book of Exodus, where were the very first judges that Israel had? Well, we go back to the book of Exodus, and we come up here to chapter 18. And we find that there were men to be selected as judges. And Exodus 18:21, here are the judges that were set over Israel at the first by Moses. You shall provide out of all the people able men, such as fear God, men of truth, hating covetousness. Verse 22, let them judge the people at all seasons. That goes on down, it just explains the structure. But I want to just call your attention, when God says in Isaiah 1:26, I'll restore your judges as at the first, that's what he's talking about. Those were the first judges that Israel had. So the time is going to come in tomorrow's world when those who will be sitting in judgment will be individuals who are capable, individuals who fear God, who are people of truth, who hate covetousness. Now, those are some pretty important qualifications. Part of it is ability and part of it is character. Now, I know we heard debated in recent years as to whether or not character really matters. There were those that said character didn't matter. Well, I think before the collapse of this nation, people are going to get their belly full of that. They're going to find the answer as to whether character matters. Character matters an awful lot. That's what gives predictability to an individual. And when you have individuals who truly fear God, they stand in awe and reverence of God, then what God thinks is more important than what the Gallup poll says. Men of truth. Men who hate covetousness. They're not greedy. They're not for sale. They stand for something. So he describes the city of righteousness. Zion will be redeemed with judgment. And this is what's going to happen. So he goes on describing what lies ahead for Judah and Jerusalem in the last days, chapter 2, verse 2. The mountain of the Lord's house will be established, and the top of the mountains will be exalted above the hills. All nations shall flow to it. You know, ultimately, God's house is going to be exalted. People will say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. He'll teach us of his ways. We'll walk in his paths. Out of Zion will go forth the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. It's going to be a totally different world. God's law will go forth. His word will go forth. People will be seeking that. He'll judge among the nations, rebuke many people. They'll beat their swords into plowshares, their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. So Isaiah describes what's going to happen, and then he says, in addressing Judah, verse 5, O house of Jacob, come you, let us walk in the light of the Lord. Ultimately, it's going to be that all nations are going to come and say, we want to learn his paths, we want to walk in his ways. We have the opportunity, Isaiah is telling his audience, to walk in those ways right now. But then he begins to indict them. You have forsaken, he goes on, he's speaking of why God is allowing these punishments to come. You have forsaken your people, the house of Jacob, because they are replenished from the east. Soothsayers please themselves in the children of strangers. You know, if you look this expression up, and it's talking about the pursuit, what Israel is doing. You know, it's interesting. You know, one of the things that is really going forward in our society, in our culture, is the so-called New Age movement. From where does the New Age movement draw its inspiration? Basically from the so-called great wisdom of the East. From India, from Hinduism and Buddhism. Now, you know, you go over to those areas, and I had a nephew that just returned from over there, and, you know, he could tell you firsthand that those poor people are some of the most backward, most superstitious, most poverty-stricken, in some of the worst shape of any people on the face of the earth. What in the world has the great wisdom of the East ever done for the East? Those poor people have all sorts of misery from every direction. But our people who have Bibles, you know, only more Bibles than there are people in this country, but we've got a lot of them, particularly the educated. You know, that's often who gets tangled up with this, Hollywood entertainment types and educated people. They read the astrology column. They get all interested in all this New Age and all of these things that they're replenished from the East. They're, you know, pleased themselves in the children of strangers. They're looking at all these foreign imports. Talks about materialism in verse 7. You know, the end of verse 7 sort of reminds me of the 635 loop. Neither is there any end of their chariots. The land is full of idols. They worship the work of their own hands, that which their own fingers have made. And isn't that what really comes first to most people? Material things. So God says, you know, that's what you want. Time's going to come. You're going to be ready to enter the rock and hide in the dust for fear of the Lord. And the lofty looks of man will be humbled, and the haughtiness of men will be bowed down. The Lord alone will be exalted in that day. Now, what day is that? Well, as you come on down, it is clearly talking about the day of the Lord. It is talking about, in verse 19, they'll go into the holes of the rocks in the caves of the earth for fear of the Lord and the glory of His majesty when He arises to shake terribly the earth, the time when God is going to intervene. He goes on and he describes how he's going to take away in chapter 3 the stay of bread and the stay of water. There was going to be water shortages. There are going to be food shortages. There's also going to be a shortage of competent leadership. The mighty man, the man of war, the judge, the prophet, the prudent, the ancient, the captain of 50, the honorable man. You know, those will pass from the scene, and comparatively, verse 4, I'll give children to be their princes, and babes shall rule over them. The people will be oppressed, every one by another, every one by his neighbor. That's very descriptive of a lot of the violence, a lot of the strife that comes about. And talks about, it's like everything's turned upside down. The child behaves himself proudly against the ancient, the base against the honorable. You know, we've seen that in our country, disrespect for those who are older, this rebellious attitude that has become so prevalent. He says in verse 9, the show of their countenance does witness against them. They declare their sin is Sodom, they hide it not. Not even a sense of shame for some of these things. At verse 10 brings out that they will eat the fruit of their own doings. Woe to the wicked, it'll be evil with him. The reward of his hand shall be given him. As for my people, children are their oppressors, and women rule over them. O my people, they which lead you cause you to err and destroy the way of your paths. So, God's going to enter into judgment. We find that society is turned upside down and things are getting further off. And it talks about people taking advantage, very materialistic, greedy society. Verse 15, grinding the faces of the poor. Then God indicts the daughters of Zion. He says they're haughty, walk with stretched forth necks and wanton eyes. And so here, you know, this attitude, that it is an attitude. You know, we reflect outward things can be reflective of inner attitudes. And if you look around and you see this, you know, this haughty kind of an attitude that is often reflected in many things, including everything from dress and grooming to the way that they conduct themselves. God says, you know, God indicts every aspect of the society. It's not just the women. Actually, there's more indictment here for the men. But the whole problem is that there's no segment of society, when you're looking at the society, the culture overall, there's no segment of society that is really upholding right and godly standards. The men aren't, the women aren't, the children aren't. And God tells those haughty ones, mincing as they go, as he says, he's going to take that right out of them, because when they're led away in captivity and are in rags and all of these terrible things, they're going to get a different perspective on life. The disparity, I think, is addressed in chapter 4, the disparity in terms of population. You know, when you have warfare, the men are killed in disproportionate numbers to the women, so describes that. And then the fact that ultimately God is going to wash away, verse 4, the filth of the daughters of Zion and purge the blood of Jerusalem from the midst thereof. And he goes on in chapter 5, he says, I'll sing to my well-beloved a song of my beloved touching his vineyard. And he now compares Israel to a vineyard, and God fenced it and gathered the stones and planted choice vines, and everything was done. It should bring forth good grapes. But it didn't bring forth a good harvest. It brought forth wild grapes. So Isaiah, on behalf of God, says, O inhabitants of Jerusalem, men of Judah, judge, I pray you, between me and my vineyard. What could I have done more? And so he says, verse 6, I'm going to lay it waste. That's the vineyard, verse 7. What's the symbolism? The vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel, the men of Judah, his pleasant plant. So even though Isaiah was a prophet for the southern kingdom, he also addressed the house of Israel, and they were included right in with these. Talks about the greed of people joining house to house, field to field, till there be no place, and the famine that's going to come, where 10 acres will yield just a little bit. Woe to them, verse 11, that rise early in the morning, that they may follow strong drink, continue until night, till wine inflame. The harp, the viol, the tabret, the pipe, and wine are in their feast, but they don't regard the work of God. You know, what are they wrapped up in? Well, alcohol, and I think we could certainly include the principle of that, that drug abuse, alcohol and drug abuse, find time for the music, but they can't find time for the work of God. So, again, very descriptive. When you look at the problems of alcohol and drug abuse in our society, and it's talking about here abuse, you know, those that start out early in the morning and continue on till night, who are under the influence of this sort of thing. And, you know, they're going to their clubs and they're doing this, that, and the other, but they don't regard the work of God. Therefore, verse 13, my people are gone into captivity. They're gone into captivity. The comes on down a little verse 20. He says, woe unto them that call evil good and good evil, put darkness for light, light for darkness. Woe unto them that are wise in their own eyes, prudent in their own sight. Woe unto them that are mighty to drink wine. Men of strength to mingle strong drink, which justify the wicked for a reward, take away the righteousness of the righteous from it. I think verse 23 is the indictment of much of what passes for our modern legal profession. They justify the wicked for a reward. You know, it doesn't matter whether you did it. If you've got enough money, you think O.J. would be walking around free if he had to depend on a court-appointed lawyer because he didn't have any money? You know, I think not. You notice he didn't take his chances on that. You see, God indicts that. They justify the wicked for a reward, take away the righteousness of the righteous from him. Doesn't matter whether you're right or wrong. There are too many who are simply for sale. You can pay enough, they'll do their best to get you off the hook. The fact of whether you're innocent or guilty, right or wrong, has very little bearing, has no bearing whatsoever with certainly many in the legal profession. But these are the kind of indictments. It's a societal indictment. They call evil good and good evil. Things are turned upside down. You know, now it's the Boy Scouts who are the bad guys in the eyes of certainly so much of the media. They turn things backward, and they're wise in their own eyes. Boy, do they think they know it all. And so God indicts these attitudes here. And he says, as the fire, verse 24, devours the stubble and the flame consumes the chaff, their root shall be as rotten as their blossom shall go up as dust, because they've cast away the law of the Lord of hosts and despised the word of the Holy One of Israel. Therefore is the anger of the Lord kindled against his people. You can't do those kinds of things. We can't, as a nation, as a society, do those kinds of things and not have to pay a consequence. So, this is why God's anger is kindled. And it goes on and describes this sort of thing. Then chapter 6 is sort of the setting, gives you the is really the introduction of Isaiah's ministry. The first five chapters are really the introduction to the book. Why is God going to do the things he's going to do? Well, it's laid out here. The same year that King Uzziah died, Isaiah saw this vision of the Lord sitting upon a throne, high and lifted up, and his train filled the temple. And he saw these angelic beings. He saw the house filled with smoke. Verse 4. And Isaiah's immediate response was, "Woe is me, I'm undone, I'm a man of unclean lips. I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips. My eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts." You know, when Isaiah saw this vision of the greatness and the majesty of God, the first thing he felt was a sense of absolute unworthiness. He was overwhelmed with what he had seen and with his own sense of inadequacy. Now, you know, we ought to have, when confronted with the majesty of God and God's calling for us and what it is he has set in front of us, we ought to, like Isaiah, have an attitude of unworthiness of our inadequacy. But you see, it doesn't stop there, because what God told Isaiah was, "I'll clean you up. Yes, you're right, you're unworthy, but that's okay, I can clean you up." See, that's part of the message of salvation. In his vision, he saw one of the seraphim take a live coal from the altar and come and touch it to his lips. Now, I'm sure he was glad it was a vision, you know, a live coal touched to your lips wouldn't be too good, but in a vision it worked fine. It was symbolic of purging away his iniquity. So, Isaiah is given a vision of God's glory. He is overwhelmed with a sense of being unworthy and inadequate. God then cleans him up. Says, I'll purge away your sin. I'll clean you up. Then God proceeds to say, "Now, I've got a job to do. I wonder who I can get to do it." And Isaiah then responds, "Here am I. Send me." There is a lot packed into chapter 6 that we can learn in terms of our response to God. And Isaiah realized that there was a job to do. And God has always had a job to do. So God sent him to go tell the people, and he told him ahead of time that they really weren't going to listen. And this verse 10, of course, is quoted back in the New Testament. You see that in terms of the fact that most people aren't going to... And Isaiah asked how long, and the answer was, until the cities are wasted without inhabitant, and the Lord has removed men far away. But a tenth will return. God's going to reserve a tithe for himself, but there's going to come terrible calamity. People really aren't going to listen until that happens. Now, chapter 7 addresses, we're introduced here, this is the time of King Ahaz, grandson of King Uzziah. Ahaz was the king of Israel, or king of Judah, rather. He was the king of Judah, and he was confronted with a problem. The king of Syria and the king of northern Israel had made an alliance. They tried to get Ahaz to come in with them, and he wouldn't. So now they're threatening him. They're saying, "We're going to come in, we're going to take Jerusalem, and we're going to kick you out, we're going to get rid of you. You're not going to be king anymore, we're going to put our own man in. And then he'll help us against the Assyrians." Well, this is a very difficult and stressful time. Ahaz feels threatened, as well he should have. He was being threatened. God tells Isaiah, "I want you to go and confront Ahaz." and tell him that not to be afraid, verse 4, take heed and be quiet. Don't worry about these smoking firebrands, as it were, the kings of Israel and Syria. I'll take care of those. And, God knew what they were planning. And he told, inspired Isaiah to tell Ahaz in verse 8, that within 65 years, Ephraim will be broken, that it's not a people. In the time here of Isaiah's prophecy during Ahaz's reign. And this would... That was going to be the case. The captivity, the fall of Samaria, and everybody was not deported all at once. Those things took place over a period of several decades. There were incursions into Israel that finally saw the collapse of Israel. In fact, just within a couple of years, we would date this about 635 B.C., which is during the reign of King Ahaz, and within about 2 years, there has been an invasion, and some of northern Israel, the people of northern Israel, are being deported. That is made plain as you come on down through the story, that Naphtali and the area up around Galilee, those were the first areas to go into captivity, and which was about 2 years after this event. And then the things continued on for another 10 or 12 years until the Assyrians finally came in, conquered Samaria, and totally the nation of Israel ceased as an independent nation. And then over a period of time, they were there were different ones who were deported until finally you come on down that by somewhere around 670, the deportation was virtually finished. This is in the days of Esarhaddon, king of Assyria. That is referred to back in Ezra 4, verse 2, as when the Samaritans, of Babylonian origin, came there. They were brought there in the days of Esarhaddon, which would be down around 670 B.C. So some of these things took a period of several years. Isaiah told Ahaz to ask a sign from God, any sign he wanted. Ahaz said, no, I'm not going to do it. Well, I don't want to tempt God. Well, it's not tempting God if you're doing what God told you. God told him to ask, and he didn't. Because, you see, Ahaz really didn't intend to trust God anyway. He already was cutting a deal with the Assyrians. And so Isaiah now addresses Ahaz, but he also addresses collectively the whole royal family. Hear you now, O house of David. So he's addressing the royal family. He's addressing the entire dynasty personified there with Ahaz, who was the king. The Lord will give you a sign. A virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and you shall call his name Emmanuel. The rendering in the King James is awkward, but the sense of it is that within a very short time, before he knows, right from wrong, the land that you've abhorred will be forsaken of both her kings. The Pekah of Israel and the king of Rezin in Damascus were both going to be removed within a couple of years. You see, the sign had a double implication. Now, the term is used here for virgin is anywhere you find that term in the Old Testament, it's never used to refer. There's no clear place you can show in the Old Testament where it ever refers to someone who is already married or something like that. Technically, the term means a young woman or a woman of let's say, who is beyond adolescence. She is has matured in that way, but is not yet married. Now, there in the Greek translation later on, this word in Hebrew, Alma in the Hebrew, was rendered by a term in Greek that does specifically and only refer to virgins. Technically, the Hebrew term means young woman, but if you look at the context of everywhere it's used in the Old Testament. It is a young woman of marriageable age who is not yet married. And I think the double implication of it, there was a sign for Hezekiah. Very likely there was probably in the royal family a young woman, a young princess who was not married, that over the course of in the course of the next 2 to 3 years became married, had a child, and before that child was old enough to know one thing from the other, then the two kings that Ahaz was threatening were threatening Ahaz were already removed from their throne and gone. But Isaiah is not just concerned with the deliverance of Judah in the days of Ahaz. He addresses this prophecy to the entire house of David. And as you come on down, you see the real implication is what is brought out in the New Testament, that the time came when a virgin did conceive, and she conceived. Why, you know, it wasn't just someone who's a virgin now that will conceive in the future. It was a virgin who conceived while she was a virgin and brought forth one who had, who is characterized by this name Emmanuel, which means God with us. Now, God was with Judah in the sense that he delivered them. But the real implication of that is that God came into human flesh. Jesus Christ was Emmanuel in a very special sense, that he was God in the flesh, God incarnate. So Ahaz didn't want a sign. Isaiah says, well, you're going to see one. You're going to see what God has done, but this is a sign really that goes beyond Ahaz, goes to the whole house of David. And he says in verse 17, the Lord will bring upon you and upon your people and upon your father's house days that have not come from the day that Ephraim departed from Judah, even the king of Assyria. And so he talks about what's going to happen and the problems that are going to come. God told Isaiah in chapter 8 to take a roll or a scroll and write it. And Isaiah had, he named his children some unusual names. They had meaning, and his children were signs, for signs and wonders, we're told. This son's name was Malar-Shalah-Hazbaz. You don't hear too many people with that name, but I'm sure somebody probably wanted to give their kids a good Bible name, so you go back, you may find one somewhere, but that hasn't been one of the more popular Bible names. He says, before the child, verse 4, shall have knowledge to cry, my father and my mother, the riches of Damascus and the spoil of Samaria will be taken away before the king of Assyria. So he says, before you're going to have a child, you go in to your wife and she'll bear you a son. And before he gets old enough to talk and say daddy and mama, the Assyrians are already going to come in and they'll take care of Damascus and Samaria. So this description is given here in terms of what was going to happen. And notice that what Isaiah went on to say here in the end of the latter part of the chapter, verse 11. The Eternal spoke thus to me with a strong hand, and he instructed me that I should not walk in the way of this people, saying, don't say a confederacy to all them to whom this people shall say a confederacy. Neither fear you their fear, nor be afraid. Don't worry. They're trying to make alliances and agreements and looking to all of this. Don't be afraid of that. Don't worry about that. Sanctify the Lord himself. Trust God. Give honor to him. Let him be your fear. Let him be your dread. He shall be for a sanctuary, but for a stone of stumbling and a rock of offense to both the houses of Israel, for a gin and a snare to the inhabitants of Jerusalem. Now, see, he starts out, he says, look, don't worry about people and their contrivances. You trust God. Let God be the one that you stand in awe of and reverence of. He, God, shall be for a sanctuary. but also for a stone of stumbling and a rock of offense. Now, that was the case anciently. The people didn't really want to obey God. When God came to earth as a human being, in the person of Jesus Christ, he was what? A stone of stumbling and a rock of offense, wasn't he? So Isaiah, now this section, begins to go beyond just sort of the generalities of his day. He talks about many among them shall stumble and fall and be broken and be snared and be taken. Bind up the testimony, seal the law among my disciples. Now, was Isaiah just talking about his disciples? Or is he quoting the one who is going to be coming as a stone of stumbling? You know, who is it that was responsible for binding up the testimony, sealing up the New Testament? It was the literal disciples of Jesus, particularly Peter and John. You know, I'll wait upon the Lord that hides his face from the house of Jacob and look for him. Isaiah said, the children whom the Lord has given me are for signs and wonders in Israel. And when they shall say unto you, seek unto them that have wizards and familiar under wizards and unto them that have familiar spirits, wizards that peep and mutter, should not a people seek to their God, the living seek to the dead? That's crazy. You know, go to some seance or something. To the law and to the testimony, if they speak not according to this word, it's because there's no light in them. That's the key. That's where you look. Chapter 9 continues right on. It says, the dimness shall not be such as was in her vexation, when at the first he lightly afflicted the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, and afterward did more grievously afflict her by the way of the sea beyond Jordan and Galilee of the nations. Now, if you want to come back, just hold your place there for a little bit and turn back to 2 Kings 15. 2 Kings 15 picks up the story that in verse 27, it talks about Pekah, the king of Israel there in Samaria, reigned 20 years. He did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. Verse 29, in the days of Pekah, king of Israel, came Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, and he began to take various cities. And he took those cities, you see, that were in Gilead and Galilee and all the land of Naphtali and carried them captive to Assyria. So this was the problem, you see. This is what Isaiah is talking about, that back here in Isaiah 9, which is written evidently after that event. You see, God allowed the punishment to come by degrees. And if the people would wake up and listen, you know, it continued to come by degrees, and you come all the way down to the time before the captivity was complete, when Hezekiah came to the throne and had the great Passover. And he sent messengers up to northern Israel and told them to repent and come to Jerusalem and celebrate the Passover. And he told them if they would repent, then God would perhaps let their relatives who were in captivity come back. Of course, they ignored it. They laughed his messengers to scorn, we're told, though a handful of individuals came. So Isaiah says, look, you know, he started out sort of light. He lightly afflicted the land of Zebulun, the land of Naphtali. That's way up in the northern part. Then got more serious, Galilee. Now, he says, the people that walked in darkness have seen a great light. They that dwell in the land of the shadow of death, upon them has the light shined. Now, it's interesting. Christ quoted this back in Matthew 4, 15 and 16. Christ's ministry began up in the very area that went captive first. So Isaiah sort of says, you know, that's where the trouble started, and that's where the solution will first be made manifest. And centuries later, that's where Jesus began his ministry. You know, after John was put in prison, he went to Galilee, preaching the gospel of the kingdom of God. And so it goes on and describes, you see, looking at the Messiah, here verse 6, Unto us a child is born, a son is given. The government shall be upon his shoulder. His name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and peace there shall be no end. Upon the throne of David and upon his kingdom, to order it, to establish it with just judgment, with justice, for henceforth even forever, the zeal of the Lord of hosts will perform it. So, describes, you see, what's ultimately the answer, what's ultimately going to happen. And this, of course, ties in here with the coming of the Messiah. And God's message is given. Now, while it's primarily through Isaiah directed at Judah and Jerusalem, we find that it comes on down, verse 14, the Lord will cut off from Israel, not just Judah, but cut off from Israel, head and tail, branch and rush in one day. He says in verse 16, the leaders of this people caused them to err. And he indicts the nation in verse 17 for hypocrisy and evil doing. And he describes the conflict right at the time Isaiah is writing. Israel is in the final years of its existence as a nation and was intriguing against Judah. Well, Isaiah looks beyond that time. Chapter 10, woe to them that decree unrighteous decrees, that write grievousness which they have prescribed, to turn away the needy from judgment, to take away the right from the poor of my people, that widows may be made, may be their prey, that they may rob the fatherless. You see, that God says you can't do like that. You know, there is a, I think one of the things that God certainly hates is what could be called a bully mentality. People who take advantage of those who are least able to defend themselves. You know, it's bad enough to try to take advantage of anybody, but to take advantage of someone who is really not able to defend themselves, that's the sense of the widow and the fatherless, those who are in a situation where they're really not able to defend or protect themselves in the full sense. And that is repugnant to God. Talks about in verse 5, Assyria, the rod of my anger, the staff in their hand is my indignation. I'll send him, the Assyrian, against a hypocritical nation. Well, that's right. That's what's going to come. That's what we are as a nation, a hypocritical nation. You know, it's sort of interesting, verse 7, speaking of the Assyrians, howbeit he means not so, neither does his heart think so, but it's in his heart to destroy and to cut off nations, not a few. You know, they don't really think that's what they're going to do right now. I think if you were to go over to Germany and ask the average German, that'd be in his heart, he doesn't think so. But once they get stirred up and once they get on the warpath, they're not going to go lightly. So he talks about in verse 11, as I've done unto Samaria and her idols, I'm going to do to Jerusalem and hers. Come to pass when the Lord has performed his whole work upon Mount Zion and Jerusalem, I'll punish the fruit of the stout heart of the king of Assyria. See, God's going to deal with the Assyrians, going to use the Assyrians to punish Israel. And then verse 17, the light of Israel shall be for a fire, the Holy One for a flame, burn and devour the thorns and the briars. And come to pass, verse 20, in that day, that the remnant of Israel, such as are escaped of the house of Jacob, shall no more again stay upon him that smote them, but shall stay upon the Lord, the Eternal One of Israel, in truth. The remnant shall return. So, though the people were like the sand of the sea, verse 22, a remnant would be all that would return. Again, looking to the Messiah, chapter 11, there shall come forth a rod out of the stem of Jesse, a branch growing out of his roots. The Spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and might, the Spirit of knowledge and of the fear of the Lord. Talks about with righteousness. He's not going to, in verse 3, he's not just going to base his decisions on hearsay. With righteousness shall he judge the poor, reprove with equity for the meek of the earth. And righteousness, verse 5, will be the girdle of his loins, faithfulness the girdle of his reins. The wolf will dwell with the lamb, the leopard will lie down with the kid, the calf and the young lion, the fatling together. The cow and the bear shall feed. The lion will eat straw like an ox. The suckling child shall play on the hole of the ass. They shall not hurt, verse 9, they shall not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain. For the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. You know, this hasn't come to pass yet. This is a future time. This is what it's going to be like after the Messiah comes. In that day, there shall be a root of Jesse that'll stand for an ensign, a flag, a beacon to the people. Into it shall the Gentiles seek, and his rest shall be glorious. And it'll come to pass in that day that the Lord will set his hand again the second time to recover the remnant of his people, the ones that are left, coming from Assyria and Egypt and from various areas. And he'll assemble, verse 12, the outcasts of Israel and gather together the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth, and the envy of Ephraim will depart, and the adversaries of Judah will be cut off, and Ephraim won't envy Judah, and Judah won't vex Ephraim. That has never happened. That didn't happen in ancient times. That is on into the future. Those that think that Israel just disappeared and ceased to exist, Isaiah knew the difference between Judah and Israel. And he's talking about things that are on to the future. And in one typical sense, and this is quoted in the New Testament, you see that the New Testament church started out in the Jewish community, but the Jewish leadership rejected Jesus, rejected his message, and the point was made to them, this was quoted, you know, unto it, unto this ensign, unto this beacon, this flag, the Messiah will the Gentiles seek. And you see, the gospel began to be preached in the Gentile areas. A lot of them responded. Well, chapter 12, a very short chapter. In that day you shall say, O Lord, I'll praise you. Though you were angry with me, your anger is turned away, and you comfort me. God is my salvation. I'll trust and not be afraid. Verse 3, with joy shall you draw water out of the wells of salvation. This verse, by the way, was traditionally quoted at the water drawing ceremony at the end of the Feast of Tabernacles, beginning of the last great day, as they poured water from the pool of Siloam there at the altar in the temple. And they quoted this verse, which was certainly appropriate. And what they were doing was a ceremony or a symbol that anticipated a time when the spiritual waters, the true waters, God's Holy Spirit, would flow forth. Chapter 13 addresses Babylon. This is what Isaiah saw. Babylon was not really the prominent nation on the world scene at that time. It was in existence, but Assyria was dominating that area of the world. But Isaiah looked beyond Assyria, and he looked to Babylon. And he talked about not only Babylon of his day, that was who was going to come and destroy Jerusalem and Judah, but ultimately, of course, it's a symbolic of the end time alliance that takes Israel captive and dominates the world as the beast power. Verse 6, how you? For the day of the Lord is at hand. It'll come as a destruction from the Almighty. Talks about the terror that will seize people. The day of the Lord comes, verse 9. And it talks about the heavenly signs and the things that were going to come in God's intervention. Verse 11, to punish the world for their evil, the wicked for their iniquity. He'll cause the arrogance of the proud to cease, lay low the haughtiness of the terrible. He'll shake the heavens. Verse 13, the earth shall remove. This is the day of God's fierce anger. This is the events of the day of the Lord. Verse 17, I'm going to stir up the Medes against Babylon. And Babylon, verse 19, the glory of kingdoms, the beauty of the Chaldees' excellence shall be as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. It will never be inhabited. Now, Revelation 19 describes the destruction of Babylon the Great, which is certainly anticipated. John actually quotes and paraphrases parts of this section here of Isaiah 13. Now, in ancient history, it was the Medes and the Persians that overthrew Babylon. Babylon didn't, at that point, anciently, Babylon did not suddenly cease to be inhabited, though that ultimately came about. Our day today, you know, Babylon is not inhabited, and the wild beasts are there. It has, you know, the archaeological excavations are about the main thing that has happened there for century upon century upon century. Babylon, the great city, has lain desolate for many, many centuries. But it will be destroyed ultimately in one day, the next time. And again, the Medes will be play a crucial role in that. The Lord, chapter 14, will have mercy on Jacob and yet choose Israel. You see, not only is Assyria or Babylon here going to hold sway, but Babylon will be destroyed. God's going to deal with those who punish Israel and Judah. He'll deal with Israel and Judah, but then God's going to intervene. And he'll punish them, and then he'll have mercy on Jacob and yet choose Israel and set them in their own land. And it talks about they'll actually bring back some of their captors and rule over their oppressors. Verse 2. Verse 3, it'll come to pass in the day that the Lord shall give you rest from your sorrow, from your fear, and from the hard bondage wherein you were made to serve. Now, it's interesting. You know, the millennium, we're told in verse 7, the whole earth is at rest and is quiet. They break forth into singing. A millennial Sabbath. You see, in the day that the Lord gives you rest, verse 4, you take up this proverb against the king of Babylon and say, how has the oppressor ceased, the golden city ceased? The Lord has broken the staff of the wicked, the scepter of the rulers. He who smote the people in wrath is persecuted and none hinders. So the setting is at the time when God will destroy Babylon the Great, which is the time right as the prelude to the return of Christ. Now, what's going to happen when the Messiah comes back and when the golden city, you know, the great Babylon falls? God offers rest, not just physical rest, but as he says in verse 3, rest from your sorrow, from your fear, and your hard bondage. I think it's interesting because when you go back to Genesis 3, that's what you find was introduced as a result of sin. First came sin. The very first place you ever read of fear in the Bible is in Genesis 3. God is walking in the cool of the evening, and he said, Adam, where are you? And Adam said, I was afraid, because I hid my, and so I hid myself. You see, what is the consequence of sin? Well, fear comes in. Sense of shame, sense of guilt, fear. God told Adam, in sorrow, you're going to till the ground from which you were taken. Told Eve, in sorrow, you're going to bring forth your children. You're going to live in a world. You're going to carry out your labors in a world where there's a lot of sorrow, a lot of grief. All that's the result of sin. There would have never been sorrow if there had never been sin. There would have never been fear if there had never been sin. And the hard bondage wherein you were made to serve. You know, talks to Adam about how life's going to be hard. Land, you know, there in Eden, in the garden, God planted the garden. He didn't have any weeds or thorns or bushes. All Adam had to do was he was going to dress it and keep it. He'd have to sort of trim it a little bit. And there were things he'd have to do, but it wouldn't be near as hard as having to get out and do the things that had been done. You see, it's not just a matter in the world since Adam. It's not just a matter of going out and planting a seed and letting it grow and harvesting the crop. They're all the obstacles that you have to fight in the process. And that's the way it is in every aspect of life. It's not just a matter of pursuing some endeavor, of going out and doing and then reaping consequence. You not only have the endeavor you're trying to pursue, but you've got all the obstacles that just dog your heels. Hard bondage. Everything was going to be harder for men, for women. Go back and read it in Genesis 3. See, it's all the consequence of sin. When Christ comes back, there will be rest, a millennial Sabbath, rest from fear and sorrow and a hard bondage. The whole earth is at rest and is quiet. Beautiful picture. You know, Satan, the originator of sin, is going to be put away, which then sets the stage for a world that can be at rest. You can never have rest with the devil walking to and fro up and down the earth, keeping something stirred up. So it describes that. And then in verse 12, how are you fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning? How are you cut down to the ground that did weaken the nations? You've said in your heart, I'll ascend into heaven, I'll exalt my throne above the stars of God, I'll sit upon the mount of the congregation in the sides of the north. I'll ascend above the heights of the clouds, I'll be like the Most High. Lucifer, one who was created as a light bringer, who, you know, what was the original sin? The original sin was pride. That led to everything else. Pride, you've said in your heart, I'll ascend into heaven, I'll exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will be like the Most High. You see, he was lifted up in pride, and it led to everything else. That's one of the reasons why when you read in the Scriptures, you know, God hates pride so much. You ever thought about the correlation with the Day of Atonement? What do we do on the Day of Atonement? We humble our soul with fasting. The Day of Atonement anticipates the time when Satan will be put away. How do we celebrate the day when the king of pride will be removed? By focusing on humility. You know, it's the only feast day that's set as part as a fast day. But I think it's interesting when you consider the connection. You know, Satan is called, metaphorically, Leviathan, the king of all the children of pride. Well, he's going to be removed. He's going to be put away. There were ceremonies in ancient Israel on the Day of Atonement that anticipated that. Well, we spend our time on the Day of Atonement afflicting our soul, fasting, humbling our soul with fasting. So, we are celebrating the removal of pride and the king of pride by focusing in on how important it is to be humble. Because, you know, ultimately, the only ones who are going to be in God's kingdom are the ones who've rejected Satan's attitude and have God's attitude. So this description here is sort of this inset as it describes about Babylon and what will be done, and this inset about Lucifer, who, of course, is the real power behind the throne of Babylon. Talks about what he's going to cut off from Babylon, and he'll break the Assyrian, verse 25. And this occurred in the year that King Ahaz died, which would have been the year that his son Hezekiah then assumed full authority. You remember, of course, what Hezekiah did. The very first thing he did when he assumed full authority as king was he began to repair the temple and proclaim the great Passover, issued a call for repentance. So this is Isaiah's message, you see, at that time and at that year. And Hezekiah, of course, responded to that. And this is the description that we have. Now, next Bible study, we will pick this up with Isaiah 15 and carry on up through chapter 35 of the book of Isaiah. So with that, we'll be concluded this evening.